Well, I guess I could tell you it's going to be hot today, but you pretty well know that already, right? With a chance for afternoon showers, and that's going to be it until we get to maybe early October, hopefully. Dr. Robert Hogan joins us now, professor and department chair of political science at LSU, to talk about Julia Letlow and politicians and NDAs and stock transactions, et cetera. Good morning, Dr. Hogan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning.
Let me tell you what my just dumb guy on the radio perspective is on all of this. I think politicians, and this is not directed at anyone in general, but generally speaking, have used the polarization in this country to get us fighting after each other, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, and meanwhile, using the opportunity while we're looking elsewhere to maybe do some things they shouldn't be doing to enrich themselves. Is that too far from the truth or not?
Well, I don't know that I don't know that this is anything new. I think that enriching themselves is something that a lot of people worry about politicians, and I think it's fair to say that there probably are a certain percentage of members of Congress, members of the state legislature, members of the city council, that go into politics with the idea that I'm doing this because I want to be a public servant. But there's also a possibility that I might enrich myself somewhat. And there are others that get into it and they themselves become a little cynical about politics and figure, well, I'm ready to get out of it. How can I sort of figure out my departure in a way that will allow me to enrich myself due to my experience here? A lot of them become lobbyists and well-paid consultants after they leave. So it's very difficult to separate out where self-interest begins and where the concern of public interest should be. So I think those things are very much intertwined, the way we have American politics and elections set up.
What does the law say about any of this, or about the oath that they take, or the regulations? Because it would seem to me it'd be pretty simple to say, okay, Representative Tucker, you were worth this when you went in. Now, six years later, you're worth this. Where'd the money come from? Because the IRS watches a lot of transactions in everyday life for people, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, and there are a lot of rules that surround all sorts of things they do. I mean, the thing that Julia Letlow is in some hot water about is an act of Congress that was passed. It was called the Stock Act, and it was passed back in 2012. And basically it says that, members of Congress, if they trade stock, they have to disclose those trades within 45 days. And the idea is, and this is a general approach that government has taken with this kind of thing, is to that disclosure will prevent nefarious behavior or behind the scenes sort of stuff. So if members of Congress have to disclose that they're purchasing stock and they're selling stock within a reasonable amount of time, this will prevent any sort of bad behavior, and it also will hopefully help public perceptions about what's going on. And so that's why there's debate about this issue and the fact that she failed to meet the deadlines that are laid out in this statute.
So this is not the first time this has happened, right? Not with Julia Letlow. I mean, in general, this is not the first time this happened with Congress people.
Oh, my goodness, no. And in fact, just a few days ago, the chairman of the House Ethics Committee, which oversees the enforcement of this statute, himself was found to have not reported within 45 days of a stock trade that he had made. So there's a long list of people who are in violation, and some of these people will, if it is egregious enough, and then they will get warnings if they continue to do it, they may be brought up on ethics charges and that sort of thing. But you have these laws out there that are meant to provide disclosure, but what really matters is if they are enforced. And the extent to which the media pays attention to it, and ultimately how much voters pay attention. I think there is a sizable, and getting back to sort of your original question, mm-hmm. I think there are a sizable number of people who are just very cynical about all of it. They look and they say, look, they're up there enriching themselves in Washington. They sell us a bill of goods and they sort of forget about us. And I think that's a lot of people have that cynical point of view. Others say, well, you know, if we just held them to greater account to the laws that they pass and these sort of sunshine laws, as a lot of people refer to them, then you can have greater faith in government that it's doing what's in the best interest of the people.
So, again, I could, as Senator or Representative Tucker, do some inside trading, greatly enrich myself, and at the worst, what, get a censure or get some kind of warning, but yet I get to keep the money?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could. I mean, you could be expelled from the House. I mean, there have been cases. I'm not certain if it has to do with stock, but mm-hmm. I mean, members of Congress have been expelled from the House of Representatives because of their behavior. So, if an ethics violation is so egregious, you could lose your position. So there is a sanction, but I think, you know, the good government people would tell you the sanctions are not, you know, are not utilized enough, and the rules are not clear enough and are enforced enough to have members of Congress worry too much about it.
And the point I'm driving at is this is not a couple of hundred bucks we're talking about, right?
No, I mean, these are many thousands of dollars. And in Julia Letlow's case, you know, I mean, one has to sort of step back and say, I mean, that's one way of interpreting it, that she was using insider information because she was had access to this non-disclosure. She had to sign a non-disclosure agreement with this company. And she had insider information, utilized that information, and then acted on it in a way that made money for herself. That's one way of viewing it. Another way of viewing it is that her stockbroker was making these trades without her knowledge. That seems to be what she is saying. And, you know, all this information is flowing, and it really isn't related to her buying and selling of stock. So it's difficult to prove, but it sounds bad when you put the things together. And I think that's in a political process, in a campaign season, I think you can expect that the opposing party will try to connect dots. Now, whether those dots really are causally connected or not, we don't know. And we can't tell unless there is some, you know, deep dive of an investigation. And that would require the House Ethics Committee to move forward to look more carefully at this. Whether or not this presents enough evidence to do that, in this very politicized environment, right before an election, you know, I doubt it.
Let me open the text line here, 504-260-1870. Let me ask the audience. You got an ultra-conservative running against an ultra-liberal. I'm just setting the sides here. All right? Pick whatever side you want. I don't care. One engages in insider trading and enriches themselves on information that they were privy to because they were in Congress that nobody else had. They had an advantage. I don't care if it's the ultra-liberal. I don't care if it's the ultra-conservative. They enrich themselves, but they're on your team. So are you holding that against them or not? 504-260-1870, 623, traffic now, WWL. 628, couple of minutes left with Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, talking about insider trading in Congress. And look, it happens on both sides. People texting in about Nancy Pelosi. Yes, absolutely. But the question is, when it comes to insider trading or congresspeople enriching themselves, do you care about that? Does it affect your trust in government? Or I got to tell you, Doctor, the text I'm getting are saying pretty much they all do it. So I'm going to go with the one that reflects my social views or political views and don't care about the enrichment part of it. Is that the way most people look at it, or what do the polls show?
I think that is the way a lot of people look at it. Absolutely. Is that everyone is somehow enriching themselves there. And so focus more on you know how they're voting. I mean, I mean, at some point though, it seems to me that people should pay attention to whether or not mm-hmm. A member of Congress is enriching themselves. And a while ago, I didn't mean to make it sound like, you know, didn't matter what sort of laws we enact. We could enact, the Congress could enact more stringent laws that have teeth, that require them to vote. I'm sorry, they require them to report their stock trades. I mean, and there's, you know, there's a piece of legislation right now that is bandied about. Some of it, the House passed one version of it a few weeks ago that sort of watered it down. But, you know, preventing members of Congress from trading while actively trading stocks while they're members of Congress, I think that would do a lot to reduce this sort of behavior and reduce the cynicism that people have. It seems like you want people who are going up there to do the public's work and not enriching themselves.
And speaking of that, the cynic in me says, you know what, they figure, well, the voters don't care, why should we police ourselves? Let's continue to get rich. Thank you, Dr. Hogan, I appreciate it. We'll take a break, come back, talk about Ukraine. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. The most recent book, Russian Politics, a very short introduction. Morning, Professor, how are you?
I'm okay, how are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. I didn't mean that in a silly way at all, but with Iran and the United States and sucking the air out of the room, people tend to forget that Russia and Ukraine are still going on. Tell me how long this has been happening for now.
Well, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia started in February 2022, so that's 4.5 years. But Ukrainians might say the war really started in 2014, so that'd be 12 years ago when Russia annexed Crimea and helped sponsor a war in the southeastern part of the country. So a very long time, but the full-scale war, 4.5 years. And as you allude to, there doesn't seem to be anything making us think it's going to end anytime soon.
There has there have to have been tremendous costs on both sides, not just in terms of treasure, but in terms of life as well, right?
Yes. I mean, the human toll is staggering, and we don't know the exact numbers. But at this point, experts are saying Russia has close to 500,000, if not more than 500,000 fatalities, military fatalities, wow, as well as over a million wounded. On the Ukrainian side, we don't have as good of numbers, but probably several hundred thousand. And they're also facing civilian casualties, obviously, tens of thousands of those. They don't have very good numbers on those. And those are increasing on the Ukrainian side as Russia's been firing more and more missiles into Ukrainian cities this summer.
Yeah, I just want that to sink in for a second, because it seems like something going on. Yeah, and it is on the other side of the world to us, but that's almost 750,000 people that lost their lives as a result of this, with no end seemingly in sight. What is the latest, Professor?
The latest is that on the ground, not much is changing. If we think of, you know, the front line that divides Russia and Ukraine and Ukrainian territory, it really hasn't moved much in more than 3.5 years now. And in some sense, over the last half year or so, the war has moved to the air. And when I say moved to the air, I don't mean airplanes. I mean drones and missiles, especially Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian refineries, on Russian ports, on Russian logistics centers. And Russian drone and missile strikes on Ukrainian cities. Just in July, Russia fired 380 missiles. That's 12 a day at Ukraine. And as I noted, the number of civilian deaths has gone up. It was over 400 in July alone in Ukraine, with thousands more injured. So the war continues to be very brutal, both on the ground, but it's also becoming more destructive through the use of drones and missiles. And Ukraine really doesn't have any defense against Russian ballistic missile strikes, because the one weapon that has proved effective against them are American Patriot missiles. And the U.S. has gone through about 70% of its Patriot stocks during the war against Iran.
So who is depending on the Patriot missiles?
The Ukrainians were. Yeah, Ukraine has depended on a supply of American Patriot missiles, which helped shoot down Russian ballistic missile attacks on Kyiv and other cities. And that arsenal has been radically depleted because of the U.S. war in Iran. Not only the United States, but some of its allies in the Gulf have been using lots of Patriot missiles to try and defend against Iranian attacks. And there's no quick fix to that because the production cycle for Patriots is long, and you know, you can't build a factory overnight to produce more of them. So this has many people in Ukraine worried about a very tough winter coming up with Russian attacks on energy, water, other forms of sustenance in, you know, a city of several million people in Kyiv.
Let me take a break. We're going to pick it up right there when we come back, talking to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. So could be a long winter. Ukraine looking at a shortage of Patriot missiles. So what does that mean? Could that tip it in favor of the Russians? We'll find out when we come back right now. Traffic, WWL. 6:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, talking about Ukraine and Russia and Patriot missiles and a shortage and what that could, because the United States are using a lot of them, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, in the Middle East, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So how long can this go on this way? And first of all, let me take a step back. Is this kind of similar to World War One, where, but for the aerial nature of it, you know, you're fighting back and forth and no real advances, no real gains, people continue to suffer and die in the interim?
Certainly in terms of the ground war, that is where we are today. If you look at the rate of Russian progress, and it's throwing, I must say, a lot of troops into this meat grinder in the area of Ukraine known as the Donbas, and very high casualties and very little movement. Some experts have calculated that movement is actually slower than the Battle of the Somme in World War One. So the analogy is accurate. The difference, of course, is that the reason the front line is stuck so much is the overwhelming presence of drones, which makes it possible to move without being seen. And the size of infiltration groups is sometimes just one or two guys, because there's this whole area along the front line that goes sort of 20, 30 kilometers where you move and you're at risk of being hit by a drone strike. So yes, on the ground, it is very much like that. In terms of how much longer can this go on, I think we've talked about this before, and unfortunately my answer is there's no sign that Putin wants to stop or that he thinks he's about to lose. So until the pressure on Russia becomes greater, I think he's going to just keep throwing bodies into the war. And there's not really a good mechanism for anyone in Russia to stop him, unfortunately.
What about politically inside of Russia if, you know, Putin's 70-something years old?
73.
You know, none of us are guaranteed tomorrow. If something were to happen and Putin were to meet his maker, what would happen then internally, politically, with Russia? Would there be an end of this? Is there opposition, but just not vocal against Putin and Ukraine?
That's the 64,000 ruble question, because Russia is what political scientists call a personalist dictatorship. So a lot depends on the will of one person, and the political institutions are rather weak. Now, there is a constitutional succession mechanism, and in that case, what happens is the prime minister becomes the acting president, and kudos to any of your listeners who can name the Russian prime minister, because he's not a well-known guy. His name is Mikhail Mishustin. But whether that's how it would play out or whether there'd be some kind of power struggle among various factions in Moscow, it's sort of hard to know in advance. It would depend on the timing and circumstances. But we don't know who would come next. It could be someone who would see much more than Putin the need to end the war. I think Mishustin would probably be like that. He's an economist by training. But it would depend on how everything shook out in the power struggle.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as always, Brian. Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Boy, a troubling comparison there to World War One and feet, progress judged in matters of feet gained or lost, and the drones complicating it all. We'll be back, WWL.